This is Shudders Inc. with Bruce Williams and Glyn Lavender.
Hi, and welcome to episode 236 of Shudders Inc. This is Bruce Williams from ShuddersIncPodcast.com, and joining me on the line via Skype once again from Melbourne, Mr. Glyn Lavender. How are you?
You know, I'm busier than a one-armed man at a cow milking contest.
Fantastic. It is good to hear.
Been a busy couple of days.
Has it?
But all good. Oh, yes.
Why? What have you been up to?
No, nothing.
Right.
No, we've got the big photo show down here in Melbourne this week, so I'm rapidly, desperately trying to get myself organised for that.
And
I've got sessions to run.
That, of course, will be all over by the time this comes out.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it'll be finishing up a couple of hours after this comes out.
Yeah, right.
So if you hear this and you want to run on down,
you might be able to get there in time to see Glyn packing up.
Exactly. Bye, everybody. Staggering out the door. No, all good. Just getting all that organised. As I said, I've got sessions to run on, the hosting sessions, I'm chairing sessions, I'm talking at stuff, I'm talking on the main stage, I'm doing shoots on different stands. So,
I find it hard to believe that you're going to be able to actually talk that much.
Help me, I'm gonna try and amp it up a bit for this.
Right. Don't want anyone to go home disappointed.
It's the PMA. You get to a conference and you get like a speaker's a badge with all your name and stuff on it, and you get the little ribbon. So they give me the little ribbon that says speaker. Right. Even if I'm not talking at the conference, it's just a general terminology form. He's a speaker. Anyway, so how have you been? It seems like an age since I've talked to you.
It's a bit like that because we recorded on Sunday morning. Been a bit crazy. I've been good. I have decided starting Thursday, because I'll be at home tomorrow. Yeah. That I'm going to start carrying an SLR everywhere I go.
Ah, what prompted this?
I guess just a growing frustration that I'm not finding any time to go and do shoots. Like, I'm not putting on the group shoots in Sydney, which, I've discussed that and why I stopped doing that. And I haven't been doing any personal projects, and, I haven't, other than when I travel, I don't really feel motivated to just go out and shoot the area that I live in, which is kind of crazy. You really should document the area you live in.
You should.
And it's sort of just been eating away at me over the last, month or so, that I'm just not shooting as much as I should. And half of it is I feel guilty every week because you ask me, what have you been doing for the last week?
Nothing. What have you taken photos of? Nothing.
Yeah, exactly. And so I thought to myself, obviously I'm traveling up and down the freeway every day on the motorcycle, and I don't want to carry my 850 with me.
No.
But I still have my Konica Minolta 7D, which I gave to Max, but Max isn't using it. So I went and grabbed it back, and I pulled it out of the camera bag thinking that I would, probably throw my 50mm f1.7 on it, and looked at it and went, oh, there's an El Cheapo kit lens on there, which is an 18-70.
Yeah,
3.5 to 5.6. So it's
not a bad lens.
Yeah, it's nothing to rave about, but
not a bad lens, though.
Yeah. So I thought, what the hell? I'm just going to throw this into my backpack because I, have a backpack every day, to carry all the stuff to take to work with me. So the DSLR is just going to sit in my backpack, every day as I travel up and down. And so, and this has sort of been prompted in the last few days where, as we've come out of winter, I'm getting to the stage where at the time that I'm riding home at this particular point in the year, it's really nice light. And I've been riding along the freeway and thinking, oh, geez, I wish I had a camera right now. That looks awesome. And so that was kind of what prompted it.
It's definitely the time of year we get some down here in Australia.
Yeah.
It's a good time to get some beautiful light. So, and you get some decent sunsets this time of year too.
Well, particularly this afternoon, you know, what with all the bushfires around Sydney.
I don't know
if you saw the news, but half of Western Sydney's up in flames at the moment. So, and of course, you know.
See what happens when Labor loses the election? The whole Western Sydney goes up.
Yeah, so
I'm not sure if it's the Labor Party doing it or just people protesting. I'm not sure.
So yeah, so that's something that I will be starting. Is at least, you know, I probably should make it a goal to at least stop and take one image every day. Just pick one thing and go. You know, I'm just going to take 2 minutes out of my trip to stop, get off the bike, take one photo, and then go on my merry way.
Here's another option as well, is find something you really like on the trip and stop and shoot it every day.
Oh, okay. Shoot the same thing every day.
Shoot the same thing every day and see how it changes day by day, different light, how it shapes it, changes the textures, the tones, the feel.
Have you ever seen the movie Smoke with Harvey Keitel?
No.
The whole premise.
My movie watching these days is like, Little Mermaid and Dumbo and nothing more highbrow than Wall-E. So,
the whole premise of Smoke is that Harvey Keitel is the proprietor of this little cigarette shop on the corner I can't even remember what city it's in. I think it might be Brooklyn. And at the same time, every single day, he would walk out to the front step of his shop, which the front step was actually on the 45-degree angle of the street corner, sort of facing out at 45 degrees. And at the same time, every day, he would walk out there with his SLR film camera and he would snap one shot with no regard for who was in the shot, just shoot the same angle at the same time every single day. And then he would print all these images and he had photo albums and photo albums and photo albums full of the same scene, just shot day after day after day after day at the same time.
That's pretty cool.
And I don't remember the whole story, but I do remember there's this one instance where there's this guy who comes into his shop and he's showing him, or this guy starts browsing through all these photo albums and comes across a picture, and it turns out that the girl that he was, I can't remember if he was engaged to be married to her or if they had just got married, but then she died and she was in one of these photographs, and it had this amazing impact on this guy. And it kind of pointed out the value, as seemingly as random as his actions were of taking this photo every single day, it ended up meaning something really special to one person.
Exactly.
It was a long time since I've seen the movie. I can't remember the rest of the story. But as soon as you said about, stopping and taking the same, photo of the same subject every day.
You thought you'd waffle on about a movie for 10 minutes.
Exactly.
But you can see, at least, you don't have to necessarily do it for an overly long period of time, but shooting the same thing over a couple of weeks, you just get to see how, it's a lesson in light.
It's a lesson in
learning how light shapes and changes and totally alters the appearance of the thing you're shooting.
For sure.
And, it's just a way of learning to see, building the vision bank, I like to call it.
Yeah, right.
I've never called it that before in my life. I just made that up on the spot. But it sounded good and pretentious, and that's what it should be on these photo-type podcasts. Vision bank. I might even start a website and call that. I wonder if this one. Better Google it. Vision bank. Maybe just replace the B with a W. I don't know. We'll see how we go.
You'll probably end up in some really dark territory if you
want. Oh, yeah. There's Vision Bank, Iowa. There, but I think it's actually a bank.
Right.
So there you are. Yeah. If I find by this time next week that someone's registered visionbank.com, I'm very disappointed.
Oh, dear. Now, we have to mention Tony White.
We do.
I'm dying to know if his middle name is Joe. Tony has posted a link on the 30 Seconds to Infinity page.
He has.
To a review of the Olympus OMD EM1.
Just been announced, yes.
Yeah. Given that this is your soapbox, do you want to talk about this?
Well, Olympus, once again, look, they have certainly, over the last couple of years, shown that they're willing to push the boundaries of just the basic what a camera can do and what a camera does do. This goes back to the very first of their Micro Four Thirds cameras, which came out with all these art filters built into it. You could dial up pinhole, and you dial up grainy black and white, and you know, all the kind of stuff people do with apps these days. They're the first people to actually implement it into a camera. Right. So they've been fairly forward thinking for a while.
Yep.
When we started up the 30 seconds to infinity, someone came and said, "Oh, my camera can do the 60 seconds." Like, whoop-de-doo. But that wasn't Olympus. They'd gone all the way to 60 whole seconds.
Yeah.
Well, now the new Olympus, you can dial that all the way up to 60 minutes.
Wow.
Or possibly even an hour.
Wow. There's some options for you.
But, I know. But here's a super cool thing, though.
Yeah.
And this is mind-blowingly cool. You can do a live preview of the image halfway through, say, that 1 hour exposure, to see how it's cooking.
That's pretty amazing.
It's like turn the light on in the oven to see how the chicken's going, how the Sunday roast is going. It's awesome, isn't it?
That is really cool.
Yeah, because it's like you're only ever guesstimating.
Oh, yeah.
Those sort of lengths of exposure. So if you can have a bit of a sneaky peek halfway through and see if you're overcooking the chicken, it's pretty darn good.
That's amazing.
So they've certainly pushed the boundaries a little bit more there. Oh no, it wasn't 60 minutes; it was only 30 minutes.
Right.
So I've just finally pulled up the
page.
So they've got the thing called live bulb feature, which lets you peek at the image mid exposure as it's being recorded.
That's amazing.
And you can actually do that on your iPhone, not actually touching your camera at all.
What?
So you can get that preview.
So the camera is talking to your iPhone app.
It's got built-in Wi-Fi.
Ah, okay.
So you can preview the image on your phone whilst you're sitting back having a beer and your camera's over in the corner somewhere.
That is insane.
Now, what did I say the other week about we've only just started to touch on the technological changes of how we shoot?
Yeah.
Here's another step.
You know, because coming back to what you were saying about, you're only ever guesstimating when it comes to exposures of that length.
Yeah.
Even though you calculate your initial exposure without a filter on the front end of the camera, and then you slap your 10-stop filter on it and you do your maths and you go, okay, so I now need to, expose for 34 minutes because it was originally a 2-second exposure. The trouble is, over that 34 minutes, the light in the sky is going to change, particularly if you're doing sunrise or sunset.
Absolutely.
And that's the kind of stuff you really only comes down to, masses of experience to know how much to compensate for that change in light as you go. Yeah. So, as you say, being able to preview an image while it's still exposing is just, that's awesome.
Bloody amazing. So I'm pretty hot and heavy about this camera. I've got a bit of gas about this one as well, I have to say. So I'm hopefully going to get my hands on one this weekend at the show and have a bit of a
fiddle.
Is it supposed to be a little bit more? I don't want to say the word serious, but it's supposed to be a bit more of a serious Olympus camera.
Right.
Being that it's sort of
compared going to into what?
As in things like their OMD, which is their like the miniature OM series camera.
Right.
They.
But this is an OMD. This one.
It is, but it's a larger camera, and it's really more aimed at the semi-pro. It's a little bit more of a it's more dustproof, more weatherproof. It's got more stuff, built-in grip. So it's built-in battery grip. So it's bulkier and it's more of a rather than where the OMD is an awesome little travel around camera.
Yeah,
you probably feel fairly funny holding that at a wedding because it's just so small. But this thing's got some beef to it to feel like you've got a proper camera.
Having that extended battery compartment on the right-hand side kind of makes it feel more like an SLR.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's back to those old prejudices. But I've got big hands. Yeah, that I love the OMD, but it's just so small in my hands. It's just
right.
You know what I say about a man with big hands, don't you? You need a big camera.
Right.
You do, don't you?
Well, maybe you should go for this instead of the D60.
6D.
6D, sorry.
No, because I don't have any lenses for it. But it's pretty cool.
Opportunity well, for a new sponsor for CPW, eh?
Exactly. It's funny enough, I'm doing a panel session where I'm basically going to be grilling all the heads of like Canon, Nikon, Olympus, and all the heads of all the major retail chains in Australia on this panel. Right. And there's two of us doing the moderating, and he's playing the good cop, I'm playing the bad cop.
Right.
But I think I might be a little bit nicer to Olympus. Because this panel's before the show. This is the day before the show opens.
So yeah, right.
I might want to suck up to him beforehand.
And it's not a bad price. I mean, yeah. 1,500 British pounds. So what's that? That's probably about $3,000, isn't it? Oh, yeah, okay. So it's still up there. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's looking like a pretty darn cool cool thing anyway. There's pretty excited to see that and have a bit of a fiddle.
Mm.
Apparently it's got all sorts of HDR abilities built into it as well, like multiple variation abilities and seven shot exposure HDRs or at two stop variation or five shots at three stops and all sorts of built-in wizardry to do that. So that's kind of interesting as well.
Forgive me if I don't get all excited about that.
You're not supposed to yawn on radio, dude. Yeah. but you never know. You know, I've been.
Absolutely. I mean, I was.
Once again, it depends how it's done.
Yeah, I mean, I was very skeptical when Sony brought out the little point and shoots that the would SLR. Do. No, the little point and shoots that would do panoramas.
Yes. Had to go there,
didn't you?
I had to go there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was very skeptical, you know, knowing how, you know, tricky it can be to shoot a multi-image panorama and then stitch it together and make it look, you know, nice without odd distortions. And then, you know, I remember going to the PMA show a few years back and, you know, Sony saying, oh, you know, this thing will shoot, you know, sweet panoramas, you just push the button and turn. I was like, wow, yeah, right.
You sweep, actually, you don't turn.
Hey?
You sweep, you don't turn.
Yeah.
Well, it's a sweep panorama, not a turn panorama. Yeah,
okay, semantics. So, yeah, but, you know, it was impressive just how well it did the job.
Yeah,
and, of course, these days, you know, every bloody smartphone does that. So.
Absolutely.
Yes, of course, yeah. Very interesting. Yeah. Anyway, now you had some things left over from last week that we didn't get to discuss.
I did. I'm just flicking through one little thing here on. Remember the Sony lenses that we said were coming out that'll go onto the phones.
The QX10 and QX100. Yep.
Yeah, I think one of them having the it's got a 1-inch sensor in it though. Did you see that?
A what?
A 1-inch sensor.
Okay, that's a. Decent size
sensor for effectively what's a phone camera.
Yeah.
So 1-inch sensor, and it's using the same sensors like their RX100.
Right.
So it's going to be pretty darn nice. I'm seriously looking forward to getting my hands on a couple of those at some point down the track because, as you know, I love shooting with my phone.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to see if they have them at the digital show this week.
I don't think Sony's going to be there.
Right, okay.
Yeah, I think they're counting the pennies.
Right.
So from last I heard they weren't going to be there anyway. I came across a thing with Yoko Ono this week.
Right.
See, Yoko Ono follows my wife on Twitter.
Are you serious?
Deadly serious. So she follows her on Twitter. And so it came up in her Twitter feed because they follow each other. And she's doing this project called Smiles.
Who is?
Yoko, not my wife.
Okay, well, I just wanted to clarify who you were talking about. Yeah.
Yoko. Probably has more effect Yoko does it than the missus.
Right, so. Okay.
But she set up this project called smilesfilm.com. That's the website.
Right.
And she's trying to get as many people in the world as possible to upload a photo of themselves smiling for her to put into a movie.
Okay.
So she's getting millions upon millions of photos through Instagram and Facebook and so on and building this movie. So if you want to be in Yoko Ono's latest project, smilesfilm.com.
Okay. So she must have just about exhausted the list of people that aren't fans of the Beatles. What's she going to do after that?
Oh, dear. Don't blame it on Yoko. A line from one of my favourite songs, funnily enough, called Yoko Ono. And so, someone else posted on my wall this week a seek.com.au advert. And for those who aren't aware of it, Seek is a job search place.
Yep. Yep.
Now, Tennis Australia, the people who run our Tennis Australian Open, put a call out for photographers to come along and volunteer their services to shoot, post-process, edit, catalogue, photographs for the whole Tennis Open.
And give away the copyright to those photographs.
And give away the copyright and not get paid for it.
What an offer!
Yeah, it's a pretty good deal, you know? And funnily enough, a few people arced up. Yes. A few people got a little bit tetchy about it all, you know? And so it spawned its own Facebook page, of
Is
course.
Is that right?
It did. It's, give me a moment for me to pull it up here. It's called Tennis Australia Pay Your Photographers.
Ah, nice.
With a lovely picture of John McEnroe screaming, going, Tennis Australia, you cannot be serious. And, so they... He's on Tennis Australia looking for enthusiastic photographers to volunteer to work at the December Showdown. Well, actually, listen, at the December Showdown, that doesn't sound like it's the actual Tennis Open itself. Anyway.
No, I don't think it's the – it's not the Australian Open.
It's not the
Open.
Main – that's all right. That's not quite so bad. This volunteer position will provide valuable experience in the sporting industry during a busy event leading into the summer of tennis.
Yeah, right.
Isn't that a lovely offer? I mean, it got pulled down from Seek fairly quickly.
Well, when I saw it, there were people who were – had found all of the contact details for Tennis Australia and had posted it in the comments so that everyone could then, you know, get the email addresses and just start bombarding them with all these vitriolic emails. So I would have loved to have seen the emails that were received at Tennis Australia after this.
I'm reading a letter here that was sent to them. The advertisements require photographers to be experienced, qualified, and to have their own equipment. They had to have a strong knowledge of tennis, administration skills, and exceptional attention to detail, and even require such qualified, experienced photographers to be fully available from November 30 to December 15, all unpaid. It is unconscionable for a national institution such as Tennis Australia to expect professional photographers to work unpaid.
Yep.
The Media Arts and Entertainment Alliance, actually it's the Media Entertainment and Arts Alliance, probably different people, the people straight to Judea, represent professional photographers. I am writing to you seeking assurances that this advertisement has been withdrawn. Oh, it's fantastic stuff.
I saw a comment, I think it was from Adam Davidson, who said, hey, Tennis Australia, you need to look at the very first of your internal, now what do they call them? Not their mission statement, but their list of their guidelines or their principles by which they function. And the very first one was to, respect and value other people's, you know, worth.
I love someone's comment here. Tim, you are a bright light in a sea of idiots and apathy. What a love. It's funny timing, though, I have to say that, because November 30 through December 15, I'm running an event here in Melbourne where I've got a whole bunch of photographers lined up, hundreds of them.
Right.
And we're getting all these tennis players to come along for nothing for 2 weeks and play tennis for us so we can practice our skills and getting better at tennis.
Excellent.
It's rather cool, isn't it? Yeah, I thought I'd get a couple of the, you know, the people out of the Australian Institute of Sport, get some of the new up-and-coming young players, so get a bit of experience in shooting them, and sure, they won't mind hanging around for a couple of weeks unpaid.
Something else that I saw, someone else made a comment about the whole idea that, you know, okay, you're expected to already have experience as a photographer and to provide your own equipment. Now, for shooting fast-moving sport, that means you're going to have, you know, 70 to 200 to 2.8 at least, 70 to 210, 2.8. You know, so you're walking in there with thousands of dollars worth of equipment, probably tens of thousands of dollars worth of equipment. And someone raised the issue about whose public liability insurance is covering the photographers. You know, if some you know, spectator happens to trip over your camera gear, you know, if you're there as an unpaid photographer, you can't be expected to be providing the insurance cover, because how are you going to pay for insurance cover?
Yeah.
Do you scam that out of the insurance company? Hey, you can give me insurance. It'll be good exposure for you. You know, is that going to work?
I guess the sad thing is I can certainly see Tennis Australia's point of view that they probably thought they were doing the right thing. Yeah, let's give an opportunity to someone who's – no, seriously, in all seriousness, yeah. Let's face it, how many wedding photographers get somebody else to come along and be a second shooter and don't pay them?
I've never done that. I've always paid my second shooter.
Yeah, but I guarantee you, some of the big guys
– probably.
All you're doing is earning the right to learn how to shoot.
Yeah.
You're there to learn the skill, you know. And it tends to straight saying, look, it's not a major event, which I thought was the Open, but now I realize it's not a major event. It's just an event. And maybe there's some people out there who'd like experience. Let's give them the offer. Because I bet you a pound a penny, they get inundated by photographers every year being asked, can I come along and get a press pass to come and shoot?
Yeah, probably.
And they're not going to pay Tennis Australia a penny for that press pass. They just want the privilege of coming down taking photos.
Yeah.
You know, that's, yeah, you know, I'd probably try and do the same thing. But you know what I mean? It's a double-edged sword. I mean, I wonder how many of these photographers who are bleating on the Facebook have also tried to do similar things. They wanted to shoot at a concert, or they wanted to shoot at some other event, or wanted to go to a wedding venue to practice their skill, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It's the same kind of thing, but on the other foot.
That's an interesting viewpoint. Yeah.
Yeah. So you don't agree with it, but
No. I can see where you're coming from. And yes, there would certainly have been instances where, as you say, photographers would have wanted to make use of, you know, said facilities or venues for the purposes of, you know, extending their portfolio.
Exactly.
So I guess, as you say, two-edged sword.
Yeah. Now I want to give a shout out to my friend Erin Manning.
Oh yeah, how is she?
Lovely. Well, I don't know.
She's in Barcelona, isn't she?
She's in Barcelona. Yeah. She's all over the place. She's on some cruise.
I saw a photograph on Facebook today of her taken from the deck of the ship as they were pulling into Barcelona.
Well, last I saw, she was in Bordeaux, so she's getting around. Right. And then before that was Dover, so she's getting around. Right. I'm catching up with her in a couple of weeks in LA, but she's just won 3 awards in the US for her training videos that she does.
Nice work.
So, yeah, they're called Telly Awards, T-E-L-L-Y.
Right.
And she's won quite a few of them over the years, but she won 3 this time around, and I'll just give her a bit of a shout-out, congratulations, because I know she's an avid listener, not. but you know what? Power to her anyway. She's an awesome person.
Good on
her. You love seeing awesome people get successful.
Yeah.
Now, I've come across a new travel app this week.
Oh, okay.
I mean, a brand new one that's literally just starting to fall. It's so new that not long after I downloaded it and started playing with it, one of the developers emailed me and said, do you mind if we do a 20-minute Skype chat so you can tell us about your experiences with it?
Wow.
So we're talking, it's new.
Wow.
Yeah. It's called Mygola, Mygola.
Okay.
Who knows why? But basically, you pull up this app and it gives you a recommendation. Let's say you want to go to, I don't know, London as an example. So you type in London and it gives you all these recommendations of other people's trips that maybe have already been on there and what they did with their itinerary, or you can build your own. Then it gives you all these recommended places, all the popular places you might want to go see, Tower of London, Buckingham Palace, whatever it may be. And you tick them off as definitely want to go to that one, maybe you want to go to that, definitely, all the way through.
Okay.
Then you tell it how many days you're going to be there.
Yep.
And it plots out your itinerary over those days.
Okay.
By grouping the all the sites that are closest to each other on the same day, let's say you're going to Buckingham Palace, well, whatever things you've put around that's closest to it, it'll put those on the same day.
Yeah, right.
So it's minimizing your travel distance between things and get to see more.
Nice.
So I thought it was kind of a neat little idea.
I haven't explored Kayak a lot, but it sounds like it might be a little bit similar to Kayak.
So no, I haven't used Kayak at all.
Right,
I know I downloaded it once about 2 years ago.
Right.
And that was it.
I downloaded it before we went to Borneo, and all I did was I went and basically put in all of the things that we already knew about into the itinerary planner in Kayak, just so that it was all there. But I, to be honest, never actually went and dug any deeper into it to see what else it was capable of. But I'm thinking that maybe there's some similarity there. But yeah, I'll check it out.
Well, you check that, and I'll check Kayak, and we'll talk about it next month.
Yeah, okay.
We've already got stuff lined up. Already got stuff lined up next week. Now, another thing I came across this week was the winners of the Red Bull Illume photo contest for 2013. Right. It was in the Atlantic.com. I've just sent you up a link.
Yep, so we'll put just got that.
Show notes. Oh, I'll tell you what, people, grab yourself a coffee, sit down, and explore some fantastic photographs. just stunning stuff.
Yeah.
Just incredibly amazing action photography, just mind-blowing, yeah. So definitely something you want to have a little bit of time to go through. There's quite a lot of them.
Yeah,
there's
right.
Quite a lot of shots.
Wow.
They are awesomeness cool. to the extreme. And the last thing I had, this is a week or so old now, but pop onto DP Review, our lovely listeners, or D Preview, however you want to say it.
Yeah.
A couple of weeks ago, they had a 10 one-of-a-kind cameras from the 21st century little blog post.
Yes, I saw that.
See that? Yeah, so it was great to go back through the old times and look at the cameras over there. how they've developed over the last 10 years or so. It's been fantastic. So I enjoyed that very much, I have to say, because I've used half of the cameras that they showed on there. So it was great. Yeah, so that was pretty cool to have a sit back and just flick through and look at the development and the incredibly rapid development of change of the gear we use now. It was great. Mm.
Yeah. Now, we have a guest lined up for this episode.
Another one?
We do. We do.
Are you trying to say something? Are you trying to kick me out?
I'm not trying to kick you out.
2 weeks in a row, you got somebody else to talk instead of me?
Well,
I at least, is it my dad again?
I can blame you for this one because you're the one who brought him up. So over the course of the last few weeks, we've been talking about HDR and, you know, our endless quest to find a way of doing it well.
I'm still looking him up to Google. Yeah. Google 14,937 so far, and I'm getting closer.
And you know, in the course of that process, I've kind of got into the idea of light stacking and, you know, light painting of a subject, which, you know, we discussed my failed attempt at doing this with my motorcycle. And of course, Glenn, you then mentioned Eric Curry from with his website American Pride and Passion. So we got in touch with Eric and said, you know, would you like to come on the podcast?
Well, he's here.
He is here. And he said yes. So Eric Curry, welcome to Shutter Zinc. And
thanks.
You know, maybe just in a minute, give us a recap of your career. How did you get to where you are today?
You know, let me think about that. Well, I was in high school and was thinking about being a scientist and was terrible at science and not very good at math.
Yeah, that'll do it.
I thought, well, this is going to suck, you know, as a life choice. But, you know, when you're in high school, you don't know much better. All you have is teachers who teach history and math and English, and that's your six options.
Yeah.
I happened to take a photography class and got several awards, and I thought, you know, it might be nice to get paid to do this because I can't even draw or paint. So it was wonderful. And, you know, one thing led to another. I went to college to get regular credits out of the way, then went to Art Center College of Design to learn how to become a photographer. I learned, as many of us do in college, that you don't learn how to become a photographer in college. You learn how to learn, because when you graduate, that's when your career begins. You're not finished at that point. You're starting off.
Yeah.
I went to New York to become an assistant to many photographers, sort of the old school apprentice mentality. While I was in New York, somebody asked me if I want to be a photographer in Copenhagen, and they'd give me an assistant. So my six-month gig in Copenhagen turned into 12 years.
Wow.
And eventually I moved back to America. My specialty was still life and special effects. I did a lot of trick photography in camera with multiple 4x5 cameras, where you'd move the film from one camera to the next camera to the next camera,
Man. Stacking
images on large sheets of transparency film. With giant 4x5 cameras and mirrors and smoke and the whole thing. It was wonderful to make a photograph that takes 2 or 3 days in the studio and then actually wind up with a finished image that doesn't require, in those days, you know, special effects or at least photo retouching.
Yeah, right.
I did a lot of advertising. I loved it. Eventually, when I moved back to the States, I discovered, to my dismay, that you can't just make a call, go down and visit an advertising agency, meet with an art director, and if you hit it off, he'll hire you or she'll hire you. You know, when I moved back to the States about 20 years ago, it seemed like all the agencies were overwhelmed with photographers. You have to have a rep. It just turned into this giant sort of machine. I was very uncomfortable, so I started looking for clients directly as opposed to working with agencies. I started doing industrial photography, and this might sound silly, but it's absolutely true. This is before the internet. To get clients, I would literally pick up the yellow pages, so like the telephone book, or like the business section of the telephone book, we call the yellow pages.
Yeah, we have yellow pages here. Yep.
Yeah, like, so they list by categories. I literally opened it up and started looking for, you know, products and clients, and I started with A, and so nobody needs apples photographed. You know, there are no aardvarks available for photography, but I came across aircraft, and I literally called the local aircraft manufacturer, and one thing led to another, and now I shoot, you know, aircraft almost exclusively as a living.
Wow.
I think there are 10 or 12 people in the country that shoot aircraft for a living.
Right.
You know, life is funny. It's not like you plan it, you know.
No.
Good thing you didn't start at Z. You would have been sort of zebras or something, you know.
Well, I'm out of business because photography is hard enough, and there's very few zebras in the photograph. I can do it, I'm sure.
So at what point did the whole, you know, light stacking methodology start to impact on the way you shot it? You know, when did you start to develop that idea?
I think it's kind of funny. I think I was the perfect person to stumble upon this. And I've explained before, I didn't discover anything. I haven't invented anything. I think maybe I've taken this concept of, and I don't refer to it as light stacking. I think of it as painting with light. Yeah. Light stacking is just, you know, part of the process of adding multiple images together. What I'm really doing is painting with light, as opposed to setting up a strobe head on the left and right side. I'm painting with a flashlight to, you know, create a much more controlled, beautiful light of, you know, the subjects I choose.
Yeah.
I guess to answer your question, it started off literally when I was doing all my traditional photography with 4x5 cameras and doing meticulous lighting and trying to get more and better finished results, that in the photo studio, I was doing basically light stacking, but instead of taking finished images and then putting them together in the computer, I'm literally taking one exposure with one camera, then, as I explained, take that same sheet of film, move it to another camera, and then pop it again for a different scene that will overlap just precisely, you know, with mirrors and shadows and reflections and all those things.
That's, I love that whole concept, I've got to say. That it intrigues me no end.
Mm.
The moving the film from camera to camera is fantastic. Yeah, I love it.
And that was great, you know, up until the client, to the point where the client goes, hey, this is beautiful. I know it took 3 days, but we'd really like to move that red apple to the right and turn it into a tomato. It's like, everything changes. It's not possible.
Nothing wrong with that, because you get to invoice them for another 3 days of work.
You know how that goes in real life. You know, it's like, you know, I've had my wife tell me, and I shouldn't. I love my wife; she's great. But people who are not in the business often will tell people in the business, as I've heard my wife say, "Well, you got to tell them how it's going to be, and you got to lay down the rules, and you got to let them know that if you spend 2 more days, it's going to cost twice as much." Well, you know, it doesn't work that way.
Yeah,
we're
not
all just
at all.
Have clients, and we accommodate unreasonable and demanding requests to, you know, stay in business. That's our job.
Yeah.
As I explained to many of my clients, when they're having problems and deadlines and things are going crazy and everything's, you know, hitting the fan, I don't want to walk in with an attitude and have special demands. My job is to solve their problems and make things as easy as possible for the photographs, not to add more stuff on their plate.
Yeah, definitely.
So, you know, when they want the apple move to the right and turn into a tomato, well, we're going to make that work, you know, somehow.
Somehow.
That's kind of I think that's where it came from, the idea of, you know, the photograph is not what you see. I think, and I haven't really thought about it, but I believe that my understanding of photography is not so much creating what I saw, I'm really creating what I envision. And whether I'm doing multiple exposures or painting with light or light stacking or, you know, using special filters at sunset, all these things, it's just to help create the ultimate vision that I imagined and how to get there.
Yeah, definitely.
Your interpretation of the world as opposed to what is.
Yeah, very much so. I explain to people, like in my, you know, humble little book or when I give my little talks, I say, don't walk around looking for stuff that you can copy. Walk around imagining what the scene could be if you lit it or played with it or added something or removed something or lit it in a special way. It's not so much just stealing stuff. That's like paparazzi, and you know that's definitely a form of photography too, but I don't want to be that guy who just captures stuff. You know, I'm not a pizza delivery guy. I'm trying to do something, you know, somewhat more than that.
Something with a little more finesse.
If I can, you know.
Now, I
have a special story too, but go ahead.
I threw my hand at this idea of, you know, painting a subject with light from multiple angles over multiple exposures and then stacking it all together in Photoshop and trying to paint it in. And I've got to say, I had a really tough time. The shooting part was easy, and the stacking the layers is simple enough because Photoshop does that for you. But the actual blending of the different sources, I found that extraordinarily difficult. And I'm wondering, is there a simple process for getting that?
Yes, absolutely. Let me back up by saying that the whole thing came originally, I'm just a very quick story, that I've been doing sort of special effects industrial photography now for, you know, my whole life. And when I first had this whole idea of intentionally taking separate pictures and stacking them together on purpose as opposed to fixing an accident, I was photographing the tractors that were at my father-in-law's farm. My father-in-law passed on just after I married his daughter, my wife.
Mm-hmm. Is that what tipped him over the edge, or?
No. Just think. But it was my way of sort of giving back to the family, like to say something eloquent about his passing as opposed to words. I'm not an eloquent person, but I thought, I can photograph old tractors. He'd been a farmer his whole life in Central California. Mm-hmm. He had literally 60 years of tractors scattered around the property, and I wanted to maybe do some artistic shots of those tractors at night, so I used just a simple flashlight, took a bunch of exposures of a tractor with a camera on a tripod, and painted light on the top, then did another picture with light on the left side, then one on the right side, did an exposure of the sky, for example, knowing that when I go home, I'll put them all together. And if you approach it very, very simply, you know, it works easily. My sense was when I finally did that on purpose, I was kind of surprised when I put the photographs together of, say, the one tractor under a tree. You know, I added the shot of the sky in the background, which is underexposed, to get just a little bit of light on the horizon, so the frame's still basically black. Then I took the exposure of the light from the right side of the tractor, so you're just lighting part of the tire, and I stacked that on top of it. And so far, the frame is just a little bit of sky and light on the right tire. It's still basically a black frame, but pieces are growing. If the light hit my shoe, I could just erase that on that layer and just keep moving forward. I was kind of surprised how great they looked and how relatively straightforward it was. I couldn't believe I didn't do this 10 years earlier when digital photography was still powerful enough to get reasonable images.
Yeah.
So what I'm saying to you now is that, you know, even as a professional who's done it a long time using, you know, in this case, not just a table and a chair in my garage or something like that. I'm using a tractor in a field. It's a little more rich, but it was still simple. What I've noticed is the mistake many people make, and they think this is super complex, is they do overly complex shots as the very first shot. My suggestion to anybody is,
guilty.
Do a practice shot. Don't do the first shot as something you're going to enter into a photo contest. Literally, take a single table, put a stack of books on it, maybe put a plant next to it. You know, stick an apple on top of that. Put it in.
Or a tomato.
You know, put it in your living room or the garage where it's dark. It doesn't have to be at night, just a room where it's dark.
Yep.
And literally, take a photograph where you're taking a flashlight and painting the left side of that scene. Then close the camera. Walk to the other side of the scene, open the camera, whether it's on bulb for 10 seconds or you're just holding it with your thumb or, you know, whatever, and expose the right side of that scene with a flashlight. You know, try to get a normal exposure about. Mm-hmm. Do that maybe also one from behind. So now you have three different pictures of that object or that scene, and then you can take those three pictures and literally put them together in Photoshop, and you'll be amazed how quick and easy it is, and it'll help your brain understand sort of what's going on. You don't need to make every shot super full and perfect. You just need to get about the right balance of exposure. Everything else you can fix. And if you just do that in a very, very simple way, you'll see that it's not hard at all. You just need to make sure that generally each exposure should be basically as black of an environment as possible with a light that pops out normally. Like you don't want to have, during the exposure of the left side of this little scene, you don't want to see all the back wall and the ceiling because it's not dark enough in the environment. You want to have a nice clean shot.
You've been stalking me, haven't you? You've been stalking me. Because if you saw my first attempt, I had just cleaned my motorcycle, and I put it in the garage where it was fairly dark, and I worked around it with a flash on a softbox, and I took about 50 different images, stacked them all in Photoshop, and it's exactly what you're saying, you know, trying to start out with something that was way too difficult.
It's too complex. Yeah. It's like, try to just get a few shots and have them be very clean, which is as black of an environment as possible in the frame, except for the parts that you're lighting.
Yeah.
And even if the light hits your shoe, or it hits too far, or it hits the wall, or anything like that, you can remove those. But the main light on the main subject should be about normal.
Yeah.
If you keep to that, it'll work great. It's going to be difficult if you don't do that.
Now, I have a question, like coming back to this idea of trying to shoot my motorcycle. One of the things that I really found challenging, and I'd be keen to hear how you have approached this, because I'm sure you've encountered this, when you get shiny chrome, it doesn't matter which angle you light it from, you're going to get specular highlights. How do you deal with those reflections?
Well, you know, we're having several subjects right now in this topic you're just mentioning that, you know, in photography school, they, you know, we're trained, as many people know, how to light shiny chrome compared to flat black surfaces or glass. You know, this is all different.
Right.
For me, like, if people go to my website, and you can get to it through AmericanPrideAndPassion.com, which is hardly rolls off the tongue. If you don't mind me sharing.
No, that's fine.
Yeah. No, please. Eric,
yeah, if you just, it's easier just to go to EricCurry.com. It'll take you right there.
Okay.
It shows several examples of basically polished metal and shiny chrome. Like one is the Airstream in the desert. One is, I think, a motorcycle. Another one is a Lockheed 12 Electra, you know, different things.
Yep.
And it's difficult. To make it work, what I discovered is shiny chrome has to reflect realistically the environment it's in. So if shiny chrome is in a black environment, to make it look like shiny chrome, it should be black. The neat thing about shiny chrome is, and especially this technique we're talking about, and we're getting a little technical here, so everybody has to put on their imagination cap and listen carefully to what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Let's just look at, in your mind's eye, a single fender of, say, a motorcycle. So you have this big fender filling the frame. If this is the subject as a test idea.
Yeah.
If you took a single photograph and it had to be fit perfect, well, you would, of course, see the highlight where the flashlight is reflecting off the shiny chrome. But the neat thing about this concept is, let's just say you're going to photograph the whole fender of the shiny chrome fender. And you can split the photograph into two. So in one exposure, you stand on the right side and light the fender from the top on the right side. And what you can do is you can overexpose it. So basically the shiny chrome part on the right where it reflects the light, on that exposure, you can erase that actual spectral highlight from the flashlight and just use the part where the light's just sort of bouncing off the chrome and kind of picking it up a little bit, and the chrome's picking up, you know, dust and some natural haze and reflections in the room. You know, all these things, take that shot. Now again, for the next exposure, walk to the other side of the fender and maybe overexpose it. And on that exposure, also remove the part where the flashlight's reflecting off the fender. If you put those two shots together and you're always removing the highlight, what you're left with is basically a very, very clean shot of the chrome. I know that's hard to visualize, and it almost makes no sense. But
I think where a lot of people fall down visualizing light painting is they think they have to light, let's say, a fender with one shot. Well, you could actually light it with 10 shots if you needed to.
Yes, thank you very much.
And each of those 10 shots may have a different bit of specular highlight in each one, but not all of them. So you just remove the tiny bits of each shot that make the whole thing work, and you leave out the bits that don't work.
I warned you guys, I'm not an eloquent person. So
I thought I'd succinct it for you. But that's the thing. It's that visualization process. I don't have to light this thing once.
Yeah.
I can light it many, many times and build the image. Or even if it's just one very small part of the image, I can build it over many shots rather than just one.
That's very true. And think of it this way. In this case, you know, shiny chrome should be reflective. There should be some spectral highlights, or it doesn't look like shiny chrome.
Yeah. It could also lose its dimensionality, too.
Yeah, also, say, for example, the front edge of the shiny chrome bumper, if you put your flashlight underneath it, like literally on the ground facing up, and then you did an exposure of that, well, a lot of the shot will be bad because you see the flashlight and there's like light splashing everywhere. But part of the shot will be the light just kind of kissing the edge of the shiny chrome, and it'd be really cool to just take that one little part where it's creating a long, thin sliver of light, like a knife slice.
Yep.
You know, that just that one part alone, if you throw away the rest of the exposure, that one little part could add a really cool sort of crispness to the whole photograph. You know, everybody's imagining something slightly different right now in their mind's eye. But yes, what you're saying is just take different parts of it, light different parts of it, take what you like, chuck everything else.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Which brings me to my next question. Because Glenn gave me so much grief when I tried to explain my technique.
That's because you were crap at it, yeah.
Because I was crap at it, that's right. What I did was I brought all my images into Photoshop, and then I put a black layer mask over everything. Mm-hmm. So essentially every layer was hidden from view because of the layer mask. And then I tried to paint in with white where I wanted each layer to be revealed.
Yeah.
Now, Glenn seemed to think this was a very complicated way of doing it. Was I doing it the right way? Do you use it a different approach? Or
I used to literally just stack layers without layer masks. I just literally would stack a layer, erase everything I don't want. Mm-hmm. And instead of... So imagine it this way. If the very bottom layer is just, say, a black layer... And I hate to get so technical because it turns everybody off, but if the very first layer is just a black layer, just make black. And then the next layer on top of that is a photograph, which will be normal, like in the right-hand side where it says layers, and it's either a normal layer or it's a highlight, or, you know, there's like a way to designate what style of, like, the layer is. I use highlight or screen, but highlight works great. What a lot... Highlight allows you to do is look through each layer. So basically the black becomes clear, and again, people are getting very confused.
Oh, so you're changing the blending mode of the layer.
I'm just using it, so I'm not stacking them as normal, because it's impossible, but I used to do that. But then it's very difficult to blend and erase them out just right. It's very hard. So
You can't visualize the underneath image because you can't see it.
Yeah.
So if you start off with a black layer at the bottom, you put any picture on top of that that's like normal.
Yep.
Say the right side of a scene that's been lit from the right side.
Yep.
Then the next layer you put on top of that, you don't make it a normal layer, you make it a highlight layer.
Right.
I think it's called lightened or highlight, one of the two.
Yep.
And then you'll see, like, okay, now you're kind of looking through both of them, but the only thing that's showing up is the light parts. The pieces that are black are still black. It's very cool. It's
nice.
It's kind of like what they say, the magic of movie making. You know, there's something more than the sum of the parts.
Yeah.
When you're doing this. And on the very top layer that you're working on, you can erase the part that doesn't look good. And you want to be, I would say, selective. So, for example, I think, Bruce, you mentioned that you took 30 shots of your bike, then you put them all together, and it's kind of a mess. I would start with 30 shots of your bike and just start out with a black layer and take the one that looks the best as like a single shot and just lay that at the very bottom.
Right.
And then take the next shot and just add one layer on top of it and tweak it. If, you know, don't go too far. Just add one layer on top of it to say, the one shot of the bike is the shot from lit from above. That's like the classic lighting, like it's a photo studio.
Yep.
Take that layer and put it in. Then the next shot you put up on top of that, that's the shot where you basically stood to the right side of your garage and lit your bike from the far right side where the light's skimming the bike. And if you just take those two shots, that might be enough to make a really cool photograph.
Right.
Maybe the last shot you could add is the shot where you put light behind the motorcycle and it's skimming the ground and the light's coming toward you. Now you're having this sort of quality and depth like it's a photo studio, but you're literally using one little flashlight. It's really neat.
Yeah, right. So you obviously find working with a continuous flash a lot easier than working with a speed light where it's, you know, just a short burst of light.
Absolutely, I do. Because, first of all, with a speed light, like a strobe or something, it's basically going everywhere. It's hard to control where it goes. It's like a very broad light.
Yes.
But with a handheld flashlight, a torch or whatever they would call it. You know, you could put a little frosty paper on it. You can put a little paper carton tube in the front like a snoot. And you could stand 10 feet away and project that light. Now you can skim it or scrape it. You can stand 5 feet to the right and skim that light across the top of the grass to kind of pick up the texture of the grass, for example. You can't do that with a strobe head because the strobe's just going everywhere.
Yeah,
it's just sort of like barfing light everywhere. You want I warned you I'm not eloquent, but you get the idea. It's very visual.
That is great.
I once I once had somebody who was, this is years ago, I was at a camera repair place for my Canon camera, getting it fixed, and I was there, and I had happened to have some of these shots just with me and like spilling out of my briefcase, and another professional photographer looked at him and goes, "Wow, this is like HDR, you know, how did you do it?" And I explained, you know, and somewhat tongue-in-cheek, I explained, I did it the old-fashioned way. I lit them. You know, it's not, you know, you don't just push the big red easy button. You're a photographer, for God's sakes, man. You know, be a photographer. Light things, you know.
Love it.
Yeah, so Bruce is not so fond of the old HDR. We've been on a quest over the last few weeks to find a decent way of, if there's any such thing as a decent way of doing HDR that actually looks any good.
Yeah.
It's a tool. I use HDR sometimes for my clients, but only in some circumstances when it's appropriate and minimally as just part of a total visual solution. You know, it's takes a lot of time to fart around with that kind of stuff, and it can go over the top, especially for industrial photography. It could look, I wouldn't say silly, but cartoony maybe. I mean, my art shots look maybe cartoony too, so it's just one more tool. You know, I'm not a fan of it, but it's appropriate sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Everything it's in moderation and subtlety. Yeah. And yeah. That's the problem, of course, is there's not a lot of subtlety put to this particular art form.
Mm.
Yeah.
The very first shot of yours I ever saw was the Airstream trailer, and that got me kind of excited. And so my wife went out and bought your book for me, which was very nice, a lovely Christmas present. Yeah. So I've donated 0.3% to your overall income.
I've enjoyed that piece of stick. That stick of gum was delicious.
One of your descriptions of your images of the Airstream trailer is that you want to culminate in a finished photograph that's got built-in contradictions. So, does that ring a bell?
I guess it's kind of weird in the sense that I've seen this sometimes with other shots specifically, like, for example, the shot of the Airstream trailer, but it's not as apparent. Say, shots of the Corvette in the garage, which is very cool. In a repair garage, that with all the many of these shots, the contradictions are, first of all, that I'm using almost fisheye lenses, not quite, but they're literally almost fisheye lenses, and then I purposely work very hard to play down that visual effect. You know, when we were all kids and we got a super telephoto lens, everything we photograph for the next 2 months is shot with a super long lens, whereas really you can just walk up to the waterfall and take a normal picture of it. You know, and when we all get super wide in lenses, we all wind up taking photographs of our friends from their toes looking upward to make them look really wide angle, or from a car from like 8 inches from the bumper. So it looks really wide angle, you know, and that's just part of the nature of being infatuated with hardware. So with me, when I'm shooting these environments, what I'm trying to do is have an incredibly voluminous environment that's not consciously, that you're not consciously aware of. So in a lot of these shots, if you look, for example, in the Corvette in the garage, if you look carefully at that shot, if people go to my website and look at that photograph, look at it and realize that you're looking almost straight up and straight down and straight left and straight right, almost 180 degrees in all directions, but you don't get that weird blown out sense of strange perspective and distortion that a normal fisheye lens would give you. So that's the first thing. And then secondly, I'm trying to take these environments, and even though they're critically composed, I'm trying to give them that sort of casual sense of that the viewer, us, the people looking at the picture, are almost like voyeurs, that we happen to stumble across this scene which is sort of sloppy and slapped together and composed, but they're elegantly lit. And so there's a lot of, I think, contradictions in them that I'm not necessarily trying to solve the problem. I'm trying to bury all of it. A lot of it, I think, is the, you know, when, for example, the thing that's always bothered me about some photographs is that people will look at the photograph and go, wow, that photographer made a great choice of lenses, or he made a great choice of this or that. And my perspective with all of these shots, all of them, is that I don't want to be the subject of, you know, adoration. The story is about the people who restored the car, or the guy that built the submarine, or the man that restored the Airstream trailer and goes camping in the desert. It's not about what lens I used or what f-stop am I using. It's not about me. I'm telling their story, and I think all of us as photographers should try to emulate, I think, the idea of, you know, the hero is the client's products. And in this case, my clients are these people who allow me to take their pictures of them and their stuff.
So it's almost like, if I could phrase it this way, it's probably very much like American pride and passion.
Well, you know, that is true. I was looking for a shorter title, but, you know, everything else, you
know. Because AP&P just wouldn't mean anything to anybody. No,
cool lighting or neat stuff. It's all been taken. So I'm more compassionate than what I
got. It's all about me.com. That's been used.
me.com. I like that.
Fantastic.
Well, Eric, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on.
I do have one last question for him, though.
Sure, okay.
A final one. It was about on your F-102 jet shot.
Sure.
I'm lying to you. It was actually the Lockheed 12 I was thinking of.
Oh, the Lockheed 12, in the hangar,
Hangar, beautiful hangar. It's not so much a question about the photograph, but on your narrative about the shot, you mention, and I'll just read it if it's okay, you say, Captain Kirk, chief pilot for this aircraft, explained that one of the most common questions he gets asked is, how fast does she go? Mm-hmm. Now, I find that hard to believe. I would have thought first up they would say, is your name really Captain Kirk? Really? They're asking speed before that's? that was just my take on the shot, but yeah, my viewpoint of the world is slightly different from everyone else's.
That's a beautifully elegantly restored sort of vintage Lockheed 12, I think it is. It was the same style of aircraft that Amelia Earhart flew around the world in, or almost flew around the world
almost
in.
It's
like the one size smaller aircraft, and from what I've understood, it was just a monumental undertaking. It's such a beautiful story, that particular photograph. If people go to the website and look at that picture and realize that this aircraft was built in 1939 by Lockheed Corporation in Burbank, California, then given to the British during the Lend-Lease of World War II, when the man who owns it now did forensic investigation on the paperwork, they discovered that this aircraft literally did transport Winston Churchill several times.
Wow.
And then after that, it was used in the war effort, and actually, you know, went into, I wouldn't say battle, but had to go in and out of environments carrying equipment and or people, you know, executives and or stuff, like high value things, and actually received battle damage. Then the British sold it to the French, and they used it in their Indochina War, which later became America's Vietnam War. And again, it saw, you know, not heavy action, but it took battle damage. Then again, it was afterwards sold to an American Southwest mining company. And the philosophy of the company who flew the airplane at that time was don't not spend money on repairs, just pour oil on it. So when the current owner finally got it, they stripped it, took all the skin off it everywhere. And in the hangar where it was redone, when I visited that spot, they have aluminum skin panels hanging on the walls of the hangar that had holes in them from German anti-aircraft guns and like light artillery infantry and things. And they said the reason it was never brought down is because all these rounds never hit a rib or a stringer. They just went right through the airplane because it's so light and small compared to an actual, you know, military aircraft. It was very interesting. And they explained also that when they de-skinned it to basically rebuild it, they don't take the skin off between the engines and the fuselage, because if you remove the skin from that portion of the airplane, you literally have no more airplane left over. It would literally fall apart. So it's such a beautiful story. You know, I love each one of these photos is indeed a true story. They have that kind of a background to them.
Yeah, I think that's what I love about your shots as well, is especially when you go through and read the narratives, as you learn, I said, yeah, the history, who owned the car, who, you know, the life and history of the thing you're shooting is fantastic. And as it says, American pride and passion, but it really brings home the love that these people have for these things that they're restoring and looking after.
Yeah,
it's fascinating stuff. And that's the thing, we see so many great photographs, but you have no story. You know, it's just nice to have story behind everything, which is great.
Yeah.
I love all these guys have stories. All these people are so passionate. I feel honored to be able to tell their stories in my pictures. I'm sorry that I'm just one person doing this on the side. I don't get paid. These are not, as I explained when I'm looking for permission, these are not Coca-Cola, you know, ads. I don't have porta-potties and craft services. There's no Winnebagos with, like, you know, bedrooms and kitchens. We don't have generators. It's me and a bunch of volunteers and a flashlight and a tripod and a ladder.
Yeah.
And over the course of a 12-hour photo shoot, will create something magical, I think, sometimes.
Yeah.
I think there's the key, which we didn't really mention, over a 12-hour photo shoot. For people who aren't really aware of what's involved in these things, we're talking 700 to 900 shots, 5 to 7 hours of shooting maybe, and maybe another 5 to 7 hours of post-processing work. It's a labor of love. And I would say we're in a world these days where everyone's in a hurry to shoot photographs. And shoot lots and lots of photographs. The average wedding these days, 4,000 photos or whatever.
Yeah.
And there you are crafting a single shot.
Well, I like the idea that, as I compare it mockingly to fashion photographers, and I've been there too when I used to shoot stuff like that, you can shoot 400 or 500 shots and then on basically your giant monitor light table, sift through all of them looking for a slightly better shot, or, in my case, you can put all of that energy and more so into one single photograph and roll the dice that it works. And if it doesn't, it doesn't. But not necessarily shoot hundreds and if not thousands, looking for one that's slightly better than the other. I like the cracking a still spectacular image.
We call it the spray and pray method.
Yes.
Like you spray when you're shooting, then you pray when you're at the computer. Taking that, and I think that it applies to any type of photography. If you can, relative to what you're shooting, slow down enough to take your time to shoot it, you'll always craft a better shot.
Oh, definitely.
We don't need to take 400 shots of the bride kissing the groom at that exact moment. Take two or three good ones. Everything can be slowed down, but we seem to be in such a hurry these days to do everything, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, Eric, I know you're on a time limit, so we'll let you go. Again, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been an absolute hoot. And so people can check out your site. It is American Pride and Passion.
Now, can I make a little recommendation?
Yeah.
If you're feeling like if you want to do it, buy the ebook download, which is Crafting Reality: Painting with Light. So you can follow through Eric's methods of shooting and post-processing. It's going to change how you shoot. And definitely buy either Painting with Light, the book, or the Pride and Passion book, because they're just joys to sit and just leaf through. So
fantastic.
Buy, people.
Okay, and Eric, other than your website, are you active on social media in any way?
I joined Facebook and things like that. Honestly, maybe it's because I'm just like an old fart. I don't get it. I don't get Facebook. I don't understand Twitter.
I don't understand.
Get a hold of me through my website, and I'm happy to answer any emails. And if people want to send me a shot of what they did, it's great. I'll be happy to give some sort of insider thoughts, and that's it. Other than that, no, I'm just like a regular guy who does little shots on the side.
Well, you just go away and keep being regular, because we love it. Being a regular guy, it's just your work is fantastic. So thank you once again for joining us on Shutter Zinc.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
Thanks, mate.
Oh, man, that was great. I could. It's a shame he had to rush off, because I would have been quite happy to just keep talking to him for ages.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, he was a bit of a tosser. But other than that, what? you know me, I'm always one to call a spade a shovel. He's a top guy. You're terrible, Muriel. I'm looking forward to catching up with him when I... Probably said my next trip up there. In the next couple of weeks, I'm pretty crazy busy. Me and Erin are dancing the light fantastic every night, so it's going to be no chance to see a bloke.
Yeah.
but I'll catch up with him next time I'm over there, and it sounds like an interesting guy to pick his brain.
Yeah. So if you haven't already checked out Eric's website, American Pride and Passion, absolutely do so.
Watch the videos. Definitely watch the videos.
Yes, and then. I haven't actually sat down and read all of the text, but it seems like you read quite a few of the stories, Glenn.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're not that long, so get my ADOWT under reasonable control. He's apparently a great public speaker, because he brings out all the personalities of the people as he shoots and stuff. So, but yeah, look, definitely, I would say if you have any interest in doing some light painting, spend $20 and download his ebook. It'll cut off a lot of the what I like to call the Bruce Williams, the mistakes. you're gonna cut off a lot of those just blind errors, that just blatant stupidity that comes from shooting all wrong, and that's $20 well worth it.
Excellent. Oh dear. So what do you got lined up in the week ahead?
Well, I said it's PMA Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday for me.
Right, so pretty busy week.
Very, very, very busy. So I'm going to have a bit of a – make sure I extend my morning nap tomorrow out to – so if I'm lucky, I'll be able to stretch it into my afternoon nap.
Right.
Try and blend the two together and build up the reserves for 4 days of chaos, which would be pretty good. So,
well, I'm happy to say I'm not going to work tomorrow. I'm staying home because the guys from NBN are coming to hook up some internet that'll actually work. Yay!
Fantastic.
So hopefully this will be the last time we hear all this horrible bloody bandwidth issues with the Skype calls.
So what are you going to do before they arrive? You're going to go and do as many speed tests as possible to see what you've got now.
Yeah.
So you can do speed tests and see what you've got then. That's what I'll be doing.
I'd be lucky if the speed test even finished before they got here.
Oh, we'll have fun with that, my
wonderful.
Friend.
Oh, yeah, it'll be good. It will be good. All right, mate. Well, you have a good week. I look forward to a full show report of PMA after, or sorry, not PMA, the digital show next Tuesday night.
Yeah. I'll do my best in between speaking engagements to have a gander around and
try and
find some things of interest for us all.
Cool. And if you see John Swainson, say g'day for me.
I'm on their stand quite a bit, so I'll definitely say g'day.
Excellent. All right, mate. Well, have a good week.
I will.
And I'll talk to you Tuesday.
Little Bob.
See ya. Shutters Inc., another audio2you.com quality podcast. For previous episodes, check out shuttersincpodcast.com or search the iTunes Music Store. For questions, comments, and feedback, email thevoice@shuttersincpodcast.com.